Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Arola. Brett Ehrlich is in the studio.
Where? You prove it.
Right here. Host of Happy Half Hour.
Yes, Happy Half Hour. We got Vinny Petula from the podcast Masala Jones on the show today. Mm-hmm. Very great, exciting show we have. Or tomorrow, I guess.
It's tomorrow, yes.
I'm usually on Fridays, which is weird. I still don't know why you asked me to do the show today.
Oh, okay, so we have a special guest that's only going to be in town on Friday, who is coming to town to do Bill Maher. And so wanted to come on a Friday.
Fantastic.
And you were nice enough to come on Thursday. And we've got a great show lined up, not only for those of you watching this, but also for Brett Ehrlich. So we're gonna be starting off by talking about, effectively, everybody on the right is now just like, yeah, like migrants, maybe they need to be killed. But they're joking, so don't worry about it. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Glenn Beck pops up once again. Republicans, it turns out, really don't like to hear any language being spoken that's not English. We're gonna speculate about why exactly that might be. And at the very end, you know how like Joe Biden has all these things that he said and how they're coming back? Yeah, we got another one, and it has to do with education. And he expressed his thoughts in a way that he probably prefers he had not. Throughout the course of the show, we've also got two awesome guests who are gonna be joining us. Later on, Sarah Kleiner is gonna be joining us to continue our series going into the financing of the different Democratic presidential contenders, this time with Joe Biden. And in just a little bit, Jesselyn Cook of the Huffington Post is gonna be joining us to talk about how Instagram is effectively making it very difficult for any kind of sex worker to operate on Instagram. And so we're gonna be talking about the implications of that. But first, the big news from last night. Donald Trump had a Florida rally last night, and they were talking about undocumented immigrants, and this happened.
When you have 15,000 people marching up, and you have hundreds and hundreds of people, and you have two or three border security people that are brave and great, and don't forget, we don't let them, and we can't let them use weapons. We can't. Other countries do. We can't. I would never do that. But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no. That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement. Only in the panhandle. So it's a tough situation, but if they change the loopholes, we'll have it perfectly. And when the wall is finished, it's going to be great.
So, in case it's not clear, that's a video where a Trump fan screamed out that we should be shooting migrants, and he smiled and laughed, and all the people around him were almost universally, also shockingly white, smiled and laughed at how funny it is that the solution to migrants crossing in the United States is that we need to gun them down as they cross across, go across the border.
So John, usually when you say this is the center of a joke, I'm the first one, and you say it exactly like that, and you kind of say, well, this is what you're joking about. I usually go, you're killing the joke, John. Of course, that's what the joke's about. Mm-hmm. In this situation, however, I will go over the wall onto your side and say, this is an insane moment. This is creepy. This is terrible. This is the moment when Donald Trump should, and I know I'm just kind of hoping for a world we don't live in, should think to himself, this dude in the audience yelled, shoot someone. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump should have had a moment where he said, this is bad. Mm-hmm. And he didn't do that. Instead, he said, you can only get away with that statement in the panhandle, which is to say, you can absolutely get away with that statement. It's totally fine. Mm-hmm.
And what exactly is he saying about the panhandle there? It's like, oh, everywhere else in America, it would be a faux pas to talk about murdering immigrants.
I'll tell you about the panhandle.
But here, I mean, look at this place. Come on, that's gonna play well here.
It does play well there, the panhandle.
I'm sure it does, and in a lot of other parts of America. It's not just in the panhandle. It's at Trump rallies everywhere.
Race relations in the panhandle of Florida are really, really bad. And that's why he says you can get away with it.
And have been for as long as we've been a country and even before.
Before we were this country.
Yeah, and so it's obviously terrible what it says about what he thinks about the Florida panhandle. It also is this thing where like politicians seem to believe, like he seems to get in the moment that my fans in this particular way are terrible. And I have to reassure them that I'm terrible in the same way, lest I lose them.
His entire grifting career has been finding people who don't see through his BS and profiting off that, benefiting off of that. Everyone. There's this amazing tweet from Seth MacFarlane in the lead up to Trump's election where he said, the reason I hate Donald Trump is I deal with Donald Trump's every freaking day. People who show up in Hollywood and pretend that they're awesome and say all these weird things and these provocative promises. And it ends up being just coke smoke and gold-plated mirrors.
Yeah.
And we saw through. That is absolutely played out every day since he entered the national stage as a political figure.
Yeah.
And it continues in this situation. And unfortunately, in this situation, it's really, really dangerous, insipid, and mean.
Yeah, because migrants are already targeted exactly in this way. I mean, we had Ken Klippenstein is going to join the show tomorrow to talk about his reporting. He filed a Freedom of Information Act request and found Border Patrol officers who were talking about how we need to march the migrants into gas chambers. We know that these militias have been going and literally kidnapping migrants. This is not some like just wild hypothetical. This is being pursued now. And there will be some people who will say, they'll always say this. They will always say this until long past America's not a democracy anymore. They're just joking. Why are you being so serious? They're just joking. The joke is just that we want to see these people killed and it's funny. The thing is, like, I saw someone recognize this on Twitter, which is 100% true. You know, back when lynchings were like a big thing and it was an event that a town would just go to, and families would go and they'd watch them string up a black person and kill them. And then they'd take parts of their body as little souvenirs of the experience. They would pose with photos and they'd smile in those photos too. And maybe there were some people at the time that thought like, oh, I would never do this. It's just a thing that's happening. But you're going along with it. And to me, that's just as bad. And I want to show something. I understand this might be a little bit controversial. That crowd is packed full of thousands, possibly tens of thousands of people. I don't know for sure that they were all laughing. It certainly seems like it was a popular joke. But I noticed something while I was watching that video. And so I want to focus on a part. We're going to zoom in and enhance CSI style. And I want to show you what happens to two people, two Trump fans, as that joke is being told.
But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no. That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement. Only in the panhandle. So it's a tough situation, but if they change the loopholes, we'll have it perfectly. And when the wall is finished, it's going to be great.
Yeah, so there were a lot of people laughing in the frame, some people who were not. But there you saw the guy hears it first and big smile bursts across his face at the prospect of gunning down innocent migrants. His wife, I'm assuming, I don't know for sure, didn't hear it. So they lean together, he whispers it to her, and then she starts to smile. And then the smile breaks out bigger when the cheering starts. And she realizes this is 100% okay. She starts smiling bigger. He starts clapping. You know what you do when you really support something that you're hearing or seeing? And his smile remains throughout. Hers looks a little bit more tentative. He has never been happier than he is in that moment because he gets to stand behind the guy that he worships and he gets to be surrounded by people who have the exact same hatreds of the exact same people that he does. And he is just glorifying and being surrounded by a big crowd that wants the same people dead that he does.
Mm-hmm. With great power comes great responsibility. Trump should take the responsibility to say that is not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't. Yeah. He says you can get away with it because you're in the panhandle. No, but you can also get away with it at a Trump rally.
Yeah,
which
wherever. There you are do that in LA at a Trump rally.
Many political rallies, people rally around the idea of freedom and equality and getting rid of the kinds of injustices that keep people from achieving the American dream. But this did not seem like a political rally. This seemed like a Klan rally because they were advocating for the murder of people who are different from them.
Yeah. And obviously Trump could have stopped it and he could have had a John McCain moment where he's like, oh, that's horrible. The thing that you said, get out of my rally. If you believe these things, I don't want you to support me. And maybe that seems like that'd be difficult for a politician to do in the moment. It's not, I'll demonstrate it. If you believe literally anything like that, stop listening to this podcast, turn off the video, never consume my content again. I don't want your support in any form in terms of views, comments, money, nothing. I have no interest in you for the rest of my career in political commentary. It's really that simple. And if it feels to you as an individual that why are we focusing on those two individuals? Why did we zoom in on them? They chose to go to a Trump rally after 2 years, 3 years of Trump. They know exactly what he is. They chose to stand directly behind him so that they could be on camera supporting Donald Trump. And it would have been the easiest thing in the world as they heard that joke. He could have started smiling. His wife could have leaned over. He could have whispered to her and she could have said, I'm done. I'm out. I'm not doing this anymore. And she could have walked out of the crowd. That would have been so simple. It's an easy way to have your the wool pulled off of from covering your eyes that, oh wait, I'm surrounded by a whole bunch of people that look nearly identical and they're talking about murdering people. Nope, this isn't the room for me. But they decided in that moment that that is the room for them.
And that could have been a very redeeming moment. And instead, it was just a very terrifying one.
It was. Let's turn to one more terrifying moment. Glenn Beck talking about migrants, not like Donald Trump, where he's advocating apparently for murdering them. He's worried about them murdering you. Take a look at how he described the problem as he sees it.
This is just going to cascade. This is going to go to where I talked about this off air for a very long time. I don't even know if I've said it on air before. We are headed towards a time when you will see massive rushes. I think I've been saying this since I was in Israel. Massive rushes across our southern border. It will get to the point where people will be killing farmers for food, and then it will turn into killing farmers for the land. And they'll say, this is my land. You stole it from us centuries ago. And they'll just start claiming land. And it's going to happen. How are the police in these border towns expected to survive?
Okay, I don't know what sort of audience he has anymore, but that audience is fed a diet of they're coming across the border and they're going to begin mass murdering people on the border and taking their territory. That's feasible. That's a thing that could possibly happen. And by the way, he said, I've been talking about this off air for a very long time. Okay, now you're talking about it on air. In all that time that you've been talking about it off air, has it been happening? Have we seen anything like that? No, that hasn't modified your belief that it's gonna happen, but that's what he's saying. And obviously, it's not gonna happen. Maybe he's still smart or rational or sane enough to know that. But his audience has just been moved a couple of ticks closer to, they're gonna kill us, we need to defend ourselves. Right. And how do you defend yourself against thousands of people who are coming to murder you and take your land?
And it's all that faux pensive, I've really thought about this and I am so afraid to say it, but I must. No one's asking you to, bro. Just like no one asked you to look like Colonel Sanders.
Exactly. And you might have forgotten this because he hasn't really been in the news very much over the past few years. He was big on Fox News. And then with Trump initially, he was not a big Trump fan. I don't think he's an out and out Trump fan now, though he obviously wants to support the movement because that's the only way as a right winger you can make any money whatsoever. But there was a period where he tried to sort of reintroduce himself to the nation a few years ago with things like this that was on Vanity Fair. Glenn Beck is very, very sorry for Donald Trump in his hat. The reformed paranoiac apologizes for unleashing forces that aided Trump's rise. Or Glenn Beck wants to heal the America he divided, one hug at a time, says the Washington Post. The New Yorker, Glenn Beck tries out decency.
Didn't work for him, went back to indecency.
The New York Times Magazine, Glenn Beck is sorry about all that. So sorry that he's raising his arms and pursing his lips.
Also, thank you, the New York Times Magazine. Why are you doing that?
Why did everyone do that? I just chose the first four that I saw, but that was part of his apology tour. He's not like that anymore. He's not crazy, not a conspiracy theory guy. He's sorry about contributing to partisanship and people being fragmented and all of that. Fast forward a little bit where he had some financial troubles and now migrants are coming to murder you and steal your farm. So thank you, mainstream media, for helping to rehabilitate crazy Colonel Sanders.
He really puts the MAGA in New York Times Magazine now, and you can't try decency while wearing that hat.
That's a good point. Okay, thank you, everybody. We're gonna take a short break. When we come back,
did you say goodnight, everybody?
Exactly. No, that kind of feels like at that point we should probably call it. No, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Recently, there's been a lot of concern online about Instagram supposedly shadow banning certain types of content. A lot of that talk has to do with far-right personalities, and some of them have in fact been outright banned of late. But it turns out that Instagram is also cracking down on other types of content, and that is getting far less conversation. Joining us now to talk about that is tech reporter for HuffPost, Jesslyn Cook. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. I very much enjoyed your write-up about this. And so it has to do with Instagram cracking down on what it calls either inappropriate or sexually suggestive content. Now, in your research, do we have any idea of what those terms actually mean as they're being employed by Instagram?
No, Instagram said it would start banning or demoting inappropriate content. The only example it gave users was sexually suggestive content. So I reached out to Instagram directly asking, can you define inappropriate? Can you define sexually suggestive? They said no. I said, can you please give me a comment explaining why you won't define those terms? And they said no.
Okay, so I get their fear, I suppose, because the more on the record they are, the more easy it will be to point out inconsistencies in how they employ it. But as you raise in your piece, as soon as they start to identify a couple of things that we know you can't do, you can't show bare genitals or something like that on Instagram, but we know that there's a lot that you can do. So when they say sexually suggestive, how do they differentiate between a shot of someone in lingerie designed to sexually arouse and a shot of a person in a bikini that covers exactly as much of that person's body, or in sports gear that might also show a lot of skin? How do they differentiate between those things? Do we have any idea?
It's a really good question. And a lot of people, a lot of users who rely on Instagram to promote themselves, to promote their work, would love answers to that question because they're afraid of having their content suppressed from Instagram's Explore page, which is where its algorithms raise posts that could be of interest to other users.
And so you sort of got into the area that I'm interested in. Obviously, there are a lot of people that use Instagram just for fun, as a social network, whatever. But there's also people that, whether they produce a particular type of art or they're models or sex workers of various forms, there are possibly severe economic consequences to this sort of policy. So in terms of the shadow bans that are going on and also the lack of willingness of Instagram to specifically define what is allowed and what is not allowed, how is that impacting different forms of sex work and things like that on Instagram?
Yeah, I spoke to a number of sex workers who either had their accounts deleted entirely and then restored after appealing multiple times through the app, but who are also afraid of having their content suppressed because that's how they promote. Like one woman I spoke to does erotic illustrations. They are not in violation of Instagram's policy. She doesn't show female nipples, she doesn't show genitals, but she is really nervous about having her content suppressed because that's how she draws people to her artwork and that's how she makes a living.
And there have been a few cases recently where we've seen as progressively some of the more far right personalities that have been banned from places like YouTube, sometimes from Facebook, they retreat to Twitter or to Instagram, and then now they've been banned off of those things. If you're a sex worker and suddenly you find yourself unable to use Instagram in that way, do we know what the alternatives are? Where do they move from if Instagram is not an option?
It is tough because Instagram is such a massive platform. It has more than a billion users. It's definitely ideal for these women who are looking to draw people to themselves, to their artwork, to their products. And so there are smaller alternatives popping up. In my article, I mentioned a platform called Lips that is a sex positive website, a social networking site where women and others can embrace their sexuality without fear of censorship. But it certainly doesn't have the reach that a platform like Instagram has. So again, you're seeing these financial impacts for women who are either being banned from Instagram or feel like they can't be there because their content is no longer being promoted the way it used to be.
Yeah, I would imagine that, I mean, it's hard to come up with a platform that has the reach that Instagram does. And as you know, the low barrier to entry, the ease of spreading content and all of that, it's hard to come up with something. Like Facebook, I guess, has more users potentially, but it's not as easy necessarily to share things. I also found it interesting that in your piece you talk about what seemed to be trolls specifically hunting down these sorts of accounts to try to get them wiped out. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that's a great example of the problem of having such vague, arbitrarily enforced policies, because it really leaves these policies up to manipulation to silence women. So Jezebel did a great piece about a misogynistic troll who just spends his time looking for sex workers on Instagram and reports their accounts over and over and over again, as long as it takes until they disappear. And he says that he's been able to take down more than 300 pages. So I've spoken to a couple of the women who were targeted by this troll, and they said they did not violate Instagram's policies whatsoever. It's just, he was able to get them removed by consistently reporting them.
That seems like the sort of person you want to spend time with at a party. So just some people's hobbies, man. There's a lot of great books I could recommend to this guy, because it's almost certainly a guy. I also wanted to ask one other thing. I know that there have been at various points, there have been social media protests, sometimes led by celebrities, to try to get Instagram to open up in this area and allow for more toplessness and things like that. Does it appear that there's any progress in that area? Have those efforts mostly stalled? What have you found?
Sarah Silverman, actually, in the last couple of days, I believe she posted a topless photo on Instagram just to kind of point out the hypocrisy that Instagram will allow male nipples, which serve no purpose whatsoever, and will not allow female nipples. Other platforms are like this too. Tumblr will not even allow female presenting nipples. So Sarah Silverman put up her photo. It was taken down. She's reposted another one in the last 24 hours where her nipples are blacked out. And so celebrity efforts have definitely drawn more attention to this issue, but it doesn't seem like Instagram is going to make any changes.
That is depressing. We live in an absurd world where this is still, and the fact that you can see male, at least ban the male nipples too. Like, come on, honestly. But anyway, we do appreciate both your reporting and joining us here on the Damage Report, Jesslyn. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you again.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, Republicans not fans of languages other than English being spoken in public. We'll talk about some of the implications of that after this. Pew Research Center recently asked a bunch of Americans, are you bothered by hearing people speak in public in languages other than English? And that seems like a weird question to ask. Of all the things to be bothered by, why would you be bothered by that? But it turns out some people are bothered by that. It turns out there are actually some trends in terms of who's bothered by it. Can you guess? If we were to break it down politically? Well, 47% of Republican or Republican-leaning white respondents said they would be bothered some or a lot by a person speaking a language in public that was not English. 18% of white respondents who identified as Democrat or Democrat leaning said that they would be bothered. So that's 47 Republican, 18 Democrat. Neither of those numbers are good, although one is obviously slightly less good. What do you think?
No entiendo este.
Could you not?
Nihongo hanasimasu. I just like it so much. I really like stories like this where it's like, you know, I kind of believe that this is probably the case, and I like the experience. I like to imagine the people who are taking this survey that are like, finally, someone's asking the real tough questions. Yes, it pisses me off to hear this. It really takes a lot out of my day to hear another English.
Hold up.
What?
What is that? On my show, I can't read any of that. A little bit.
You're gonna hate the Gaelic one later.
Oh my god, again! On my air! What is
Republican? I
don't know how to.
What is that?
Show.
I don't know. That's Scotch Gaelic, according to Google Translate.
Is it Scotch Gaelic? Because it actually looks like Elvish. I don't know anything. I've studied a few languages.
Those who are reading the podcast, we're having a psychotic episode. Exactly. There's no reason for us to be doing this.
Okay, wait. I want to give some more information before we launch into it.
See this.
58% of white Democrats said they wouldn't be bothered. 26% of white Republicans also answered the same. But that is, to me, more interesting than those who admitted that they'd be bothered. That means out of a huge group of Republicans, only 1 in 4 wouldn't be bothered or aren't sure if they'd be bothered. But, and what does that answer even mean? You've been in public, you've heard people speak languages, you don't know yet whether you'd be bothered. Those people are bothered, okay? Can we just admit that?
It just bothers me so much that we Americans don't have our own language. Here we are speaking some stupid empire's dumb, stupid language. Mm-hmm. And that's why I advocate on behalf of my Republican brothers and sisters to just use words that have been invented in English since the invention of America. Hamburger, McDonald's, French fry.
Anyway, really fast, I want to break this down by race though, because 34% of all respondents, white respondents, regardless of party, would be bothered by this. 24% of black respondents, the same percentage of Asian respondents, 14% of Hispanics said the same. And look, we're obviously joking around because we don't take anything seriously anymore because our ability to seriously engage with the news has been destroyed by the last few years. But this is serious because the percentage who say that it would bother them, for the most part, they'll take it out on their partner later. They'll complain or something. But some don't just complain. Some take it farther. So let's take just a brief tour through how this plays out day by day across the country through a few headlines. California gas station clerk fired after ranting against woman speaking Spanish. He doesn't just take it internally. He takes it to his job and he attacks people who speak Spanish. Texas principal under fire for alleged anti-immigrant bullying and harassment, including for people who are speaking Spanish. Restaurant worker who says she was fired for speaking Spanish fights back. People are losing their jobs. People are getting attacked for speaking this language. Some just get annoyed. Others turn it into violence or, you know, political activism on the right. So this is incredibly consequential in practice.
Yeah.
Really fast.
Free speech,
my girlfriend, who is Mexican American, she was like physically accosted not long after Donald Trump's election in a laundromat. She was speaking Spanish to a friend of hers, and the woman got up in her face, backed her up to the table, and started ranting about making America great again and stuff like that. Triggered so much by simply hearing a little bit of Spanish spoken casually in a public place that she considered the possibility of assaulting a person that she didn't know.
And you can, yeah. It's insane, and this is just like the weird trickle that ends up being making someone feel comfortable enough to accost someone. And that is the difference between free speech and just being a jerk in a way that you have legal liability for.
Yeah.
When you go and essentially assault someone in a laundromat. And I am not hurting your free speech by pointing out that you're being a jerk when you do that. And if you work at a gas station and you rant against a customer for speaking Spanish, you're legally allowed to do that. But if I run that gas station, I should absolutely be allowed to fire you for it.
For attacking a person.
For attacking a customer.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you think that this is sort of, I get it. It's a little bit weird for a Pew poll. But this is important, and this also means something. Steve King, who's like just an out and out white nationalist, white supremacist in office right now, going around, you know, publicly supporting other white supremacists in other elections in other countries. How did he get his start? He got his start pushing English is the only acceptable language legislation. That's what he did. That's what he got elected on. When he was a new representative, that's what he was pushing. So this is a hot button thing for those sorts of people, and it represents something far more, and something I would say far more insidious.
Yeah.
Anyway,
oh. Go for it.
No, you go. You have the last comment.
It just really makes me very angry in a general way to see that this is the way things are developing in this nation, because the three stories, including this one that we've discussed, are about essentially a shift in what people feel is acceptable in this country. And when they're talking about making America great again, they're not. The way they describe their approach to doing that is not great at all.
No.
It is the worst. It caters to the worst instincts and it makes America terrible.
Yeah.
And I think I totally am fine with the concept of making America great again. I think America's great when people are allowed to speak whatever damn language they want.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, a lot of times I'd prefer that it wasn't English, because if it's not English, I can't understand it. I was at a restaurant last night, and in a neighboring restaurant, group of young people came out, and one said really loudly, "We need to figure out who's gonna bring Jordan home, who lives closest to Jordan." And then presumably Jordan said something, and then that main person said, "Ugh, no Jordan." And if they'd been speaking any language other than English, I would not have had to know how horribly they treated Jordan. But now I know the group dynamic, and it makes me sad.
It's amazing.
Anyway, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Joe Biden's funders, finances, donors, all of that, we'll be delving into it after this. It's time now for part 9 of our ongoing series, delving into the financing and donors of the Democratic presidential primary contenders. And joining us now to break down the financing of Joe Biden, Sarah Kleiner, federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Thank you for your ongoing work analyzing these candidates. So Joe Biden, he's a person that we know quite a bit about in comparison to some others, but not necessarily specifically about his financing. So I want to run through some of the normal questions that we go through. In terms of like personal wealth, ability to self-finance his campaign, how does he stack up?
So Joe Biden doesn't have the level of wealth, or at least as far as we know from his last financial disclosures, he didn't have the kind of wealth that, say, an Elizabeth Warren had. He actually was potentially in the hole in 2016. His assets were below about $1 million. His liabilities were about that much too. So he's since then gained wealth for the first time through speeches and books, according to the New York Times. So he is financially in a better place than he was in 2016.
I think that is one of the most fascinating things about your write-up that people can find at the Center for Public Integrity. I would have just assumed that for the time that he's spent in Washington and in the White House and his time since, that he would have written books and given speeches and all that. But he's actually, like, look, he's very wealthy compared to a regular person, but compared to the other candidates, not necessarily the case, which is very interesting. So also, he's been fundraising for a very long time, many Senate campaigns and all of that. How successful has he been overall in generating donations?
Sure. He's been in federal politics for almost 5 decades. It's a long time. He's run for president twice unsuccessfully. This is his third bid. He has been a successful fundraiser in the past. This is going to be a very interesting race on the Democratic side, because a lot of the candidates are really pushing hard for small dollar donors. And they're making a huge deal about trying to get as many people giving small dollar contributions, if we're talking about $200 or less. Joe Biden actually has kind of made a push for large contributions. It seems like he's relying on some of the party's wealthiest donors to help his campaign. He raised $6.3 million, his campaign announced, in the first 24 hours. Wow. That was from 96,000 people. In the first quarter, Bernie Sanders raised money from 525,000 people. Mm. So Biden is definitely, and since he announced so late, he's going to be playing some catch up as far as getting grassroots donors to support his campaign.
That's interesting. So he does have a lot of donors, but not necessarily as much as some of the others who stress that sort of financing more and have been around for longer. He actually had sort of a contest or some sort of game or something to try to generate more small donors, right?
Sure. Yeah, he was trying to generate interest through people, a contest to give me $5 and you can win a trip to meet me. And he, like other candidates, selling tote bags and mugs and that sort of thing, emblazoned with his image. Mm-hmm.
And Make America Obama Again hats, I suppose. Anyway, let's talk about one of the most important areas. Since for him, we have a lot of information going back decades. What sorts of either industries stand out as being supportive of Joe Biden? Are there particular individuals that are noteworthy for having supported him in the past?
Yes. His PAC is American Possibilities. It was formed in 2017, and so we have records from when it was formed in 2017 through the end of 2018. It raised $2.6 million. Some of the notable donors to that PAC include Timothy Gill, an entrepreneur in Colorado, and a gay rights activist. And then also the Hollywood producers, Steven Spielberg, Jeffrey Katzenberg. Those individuals gave to American Possibilities. And then we also saw from industry, we saw some contributions from, this is typical, from lawyers and people who are retired. A lot of contributions from those two groups, but also labor unions. And that's an issue that Joe Biden has actually recently tussled with President Trump over, his support of labor unions and who is going to have that support in 2020. A lot of the blue collar working class folks ended up defecting from the Democratic Party to Trump's camp in 2016. So it's going to be interesting to see where those voters go in 2020 if Biden is on the ticket.
And I'm also curious, in terms of some of the big fundraisers that he's had in the time since he announced, have you been tracking any of who might have been supporting those or helping to organize fundraisers or anything like that?
Yeah, we're keeping an eye on it, and I don't have any specifics for you right now. But okay. But yeah, it's something we're monitoring and watching.
And so more broadly, I'm also curious about sort of philosophically how the different candidates approach financing their campaigns. Has he, similar to other candidates, insisted that he will not take PAC donations, or you know, where does he stand on fossil fuel money? Does he support campaign finance reform? Like outside of just his campaign, what does he think about financing in politics?
Yeah, so he hasn't really stepped out there like other, like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have in terms of shunning big contributions or PAC financing. But he, in terms of campaign finance, he actually penned a column recently about dark money and how it needs to be eliminated from politics. And dark money is money that, you know, you can't trace the source of it. So it comes from nonprofit spending, and we just have no way of knowing who is backing a particular candidate when they're supported by dark money. So he spoke out against that. However, when he was running with Barack Obama, there's a strong possibility that Priorities USA, that they benefited from the dark money spending by Priorities USA.
Hmm. Okay, well, perhaps he's evolved on that as well. That's a good reform to make. I consider that like the ground floor in terms of reforms that you can do to campaign finance, but that's good information. We appreciate that. Sarah Kleiner, federal politics reporter for Center for Public Integrity, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a short break here, and when we come back, a little bit more from Joe Biden. Comments from 2007 about education, where he stands on that. We'll be talking about it after this. Just time for one more story, unfortunately, so let's turn to something a little bit controversial. Back in 2007, Joe Biden was speaking with the Washington Post, and they talked about a bunch of different topics. And I want to focus on one section in particular that does not look very good. So they said at the time, again, 2007, after a lengthy critique of Bush administration education policies, Biden attempted to explain why some schools perform better than others. For instance, in Iowa as compared to Washington, D.C. And here's what Joe Biden said. There's less than 1% of the population of Iowa that is African American. There's probably less than 4 or 5% that are minorities. What is in Washington? So look, it goes back to what you start off with, what you're dealing with. When you have children coming from dysfunctional homes, when you have children coming from homes where there's no books, where the mother from the time they're born doesn't talk to them, as opposed to the mother in Iowa who's sitting out there and talks to them, the kid starts out with a 300 word larger vocabulary at age 3. Half this education gap exists before the kid steps foot in the classroom.
Where'd you get it from, buddy? Where did you get that information from?
The 300 words thing?
Just all of it.
You talking to me or him?
No.
I got it from the Washington Post.
You got it from the Washington Post, as it was said very clearly in the graphic. Where does Joe Biden get it from?
I don't know. The 300 word thing in particular, I don't know.
Oh, it's very obvious where he gets it from. Just like his gut. Mm-hmm. And his gut is racist. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, certainly advancing stereotypes.
Yeah, That's it. But that is the racist aspect of it. Mm-hmm. It is using this stereotype that he doesn't get from anywhere. Mm-hmm. He's just saying things, and it's based on this inherent understanding he feels he has. His instincts about America are racist. They are, all right, guys, it's just me, Joe, you, let's hang out. Black people, they don't take care of their kids. We mm-hmm. do. Iowa, on a homestead, close your eyes, look out, as far as the eye can see, it's just corn and whites, and that's good. And and he's not saying, in his mind, he's not saying it terribly.
Yeah.
He's just like, listen, let's level. And if you look back even further than that to like the 90s crime bill, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's all those.
It's
all
let's be honest for once.
Yeah. It's those inherently racist understandings mm-hmm. of America that he thinks is just him cutting to the core because yeah. he's Joe.
Well, and by the way, that whole thing where it's like, okay, let's push aside all of the political correct. This is just effectively what he's saying without saying and said in the 90s. That's the same exact thing that Republicans do. That's what the politicians do. That's what, you know, like that's the Dave Rubin, Ben Shapiro thing. It's like everybody else is being fake and not acknowledging the truth. We're the ones who are brave enough to admit that all of the stereotypes we believe about minorities are probably true. That's what they say. And he is, I'm not saying it's the same exact thing, but I'm saying it's the same sort of thing. Now, what's interesting to me is that when he's asked about the education policies, what he comes up with is not just a comparison between Iowa and Washington, D.C., but whether the numbers are right or not, I don't know. But he has the statistics already in his head. Like he knows what percentage of Iowa and what percentage of Washington, D.C. He references that. He doesn't talk in broad terms, he talks in fairly specific terms, which implies to me that this is something that he's thought about before and has not, in all that time thinking about it, learned a way to describe it or get it across without sounding racist.
Right.
Now, can I give his response, just for fairness?
Yes, let me check the show name. Yeah, with yes. John Iadarola, go
so,
for it.
So the Biden campaign moved quickly to clarify his remarks at a statement saying, this was not a race-based distinction, but a discussion of the problems kids face who don't have the same socioeconomic support system and all that implies, nutrition, pre-K, et cetera, entering grade school and the impact of those disadvantages on outcomes.
But black people are worse. Do we just agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, look, the thing is, I don't go that far. I don't think that he's sitting there thinking that that's what he thinks. I mm-hmm. bet he was smiling when he said it and it was charming and folksy or whatever. The whole interview probably was.
Yeah, I agree with
that. He doesn't think that he's talking about it in that way, but he is talking about it in that
yes.
way. And we all have these biases that come about from where we were born, what we were exposed to and all of that stuff, but it is on us, the onus is on us, not on everyone else, to move past that and to understand where we're coming from. And that statement from him, when he was, you know, he was much younger, he was 60. He was a young man, a ripe young age of 60, hasn't done that. And we're supposed to believe that in the 10 years since he finally did, maybe, but he's got a lot of splaining to do about yeah. this, honestly.
It's just with Biden, it's the big give up. Like that's what it is. It's the big give up. It's like, mm-hmm. listen, Biden's gonna take us back to a place where at least people were inherently racist in their framing of their heuristic approach to America in quiet, in secret, in their homes,
yeah.
as opposed to, it almost felt like we were having a conversation for a minute and then it got really weird and racist at Trump rallies.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Like let's just go back to people like Joe being
a great
killer.
I don't want to have to start the show with racism at a Republican rally and then close it with, is our candidate going to be, I mean, obviously better in that area, but yeah. 100% better? No, probably not. That's not what I want.
Banal racism versus overt.
Exactly. I don't like either.
Yeah.
Thank you, as always. Great to have you on. You're the best. Just happy half hour.
Happy half hour. I'm just choking back at no one likes banal jokes.
No. Jeez. Okay, thank you, everybody. We will see you tomorrow morning.
's for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Iadarola. I'll see you soon.